some problems associated with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, kind of the central dynamical equation of the of canonical quantum gravity, and the quantized version of the Hamiltonian constraint. Now, we had then started asking ourselves whether the situation might improve if one doesn't use the standard metric variables, but instead uses a different set of classical variables, which classically give an entirely equivalent description of GR, but might lead, at least in practical terms, to a different outlook on the quantum theory. Now, I started by introducing those in a rather sketchy way, because we don't really have time for a full-blown derivation here. Basically, what one looks at is a variant of the so-called first-order formulation for gravity. In the first-order formulation, you consider, well, the Fierbein, which is that's essentially equivalent to metric, but as an independent variable, you consider the connection. And then, well, you work out the Euler-Lagrange equations for both, and then substitute one, the solution of one into the other, and then you see that you reproduce exactly the standard Einstein equations. Now, one particular way of setting up such a first-order formulation leads to variables that now do look very interesting once you've done the 3 plus 1 decomposition. And those were kind of the Ashtekar connections, I might call them. And they lead, after partial gauge fixing, to Young-Mills-type variables in the canonical formulation of the theory. So we had conjugate variable pairs, capital A, that's a connection variable, and kind of a generalized electric field variable, capital E, I called it, Bj of x. And they were really were kind of standard Young-Mills phase space variables, where the gauge group was SO3, or I said that for various reasons one actually often goes to SU2, and that, well, that will do from now on. Now, these variables, they parameterize, of course, not the real physical phase space, but the extended phase space, so where we start formulating the dynamics, which still has now a lot of redundancy in it. I mean, uninteresting kind of unphysical information. So they span what I call an extended unphysical, in the sense I just mentioned, a phase space. And basically, well, you can think of those, for those of you in the know with this type of lingo, as a cotangent bundle over the configuration space, which is just spanned purely by these connection variables. And the space I called a curly A. And I can put an index to denote the relevant gauge group. OK, and then we saw that this then suggests, at least formally, a quantization where the A's, now in a Schrödinger style the quantization, are represented by multiplication on wave functions that have A as their arguments again, and the E are represented by partial differentiation. So schematically, A hat applied on psi of A gives you an A on the psi, and the E hat on psi of A is proportional to functional partial derivative of the wave functions. Now, something that's perhaps worth noting is that the situation is inverse to what one would usually do in the metric formulation. Okay, in the metric formulation, we had canonically conjugate variable pairs hij, spatial metric, which we would represent by multiplication, and conjugate momenta, which we called pi. Now you see, what I of course told you is that this is essentially the square root of the metric. So, but the metric, of course, used to be the configuration variable. So now, in this Young-Mills-like setting, the ease or the straightforward, the three-dimensional metric information is, of course, encoded in here, appears as a momentum variable. So therefore, it appears kind of naturally as kind of as a differential in the quantization. So that's kind of the opposite situation from what we saw happens in the metric formulation. Okay, then I started saying, well, these are kind of interesting. One might want to borrow quantization techniques from Young-Mills theory. And indeed, one does use, in an essential way, an idea that comes from there, which is that there exist nice variables that project down to the quotient with respect to gauge transformation, both of this configuration space and, effectively also the entire phase space. So that was kind of the idea here, essential, a key idea for the further construction. We choose these Wilson loop variables. For which I introduced this notation W. Gamma is a closed curve or a loop on the spatial manifold, and they are given by the trace of the holonomy of the connection form A along the curve gamma. So here is my spatial three manifold sigma. And here is some closed curve gamma. And yesterday, in the exercises, you learned precisely what kind of object this holonomy was. And that indeed, after taking the trace, this became a gauge invariant object. So that is no longer sensitive to gauge transformations. That is true classically and continues to hold true once we elevate these kind of essentially to gauge invariant, well, to quantum states. So think of them as a specific type of psi of A, namely being invariant under local gauge transformation. So the idea is to use those now as coordinates on the quotient space A with respect to the action, the local action of the gauge group SU2. So classically, that seems a fairly innocent looking idea, and certainly in a way correct idea, because one can show that if I know all the Wilson loops, then I can construct for you uniquely the connection A modulo gauge transformations. Of course, I can only reconstruct kind of the orbit for you. So I haven't lost any information in doing this. So, and the key idea to use these variables goes back to Rovelli and Smolin. To use them in gravity, 1990. Of course, Smolin being on the faculty here at PI. So of course, we are not sticking just to using them classically. Now, remember the discussion we had when we were discussing the non-existence of unique quantization procedure for a given classical theory. And one of the statements we made then was to say, well, certainly, given some a classical phase space, We saw that from this little kind of toy example, even on for quantization on R2n, we won't ever be able to quantize in an exact manner all phase space functions in such a way that their Poisson algebra kind of is exactly represented, found back as a commutator algebra in the quantum theory. It's simply impossible. And then I told you, well, what you then have to do is usually is to make some natural choice. So if you sit on a linear phase space, a natural choice would be a kind of Schrodinger type quantization. Now, we are in gravity, and one can now say, aha, well, these seem to be a very good set of variables that at least get rid of part of my gauge degrees of freedom. Namely, there was kind of three of them, get rid of 3 out of 7. So why not work with those and take them as my selected phase-based variables plus suitable conjugate momenta, because they know only about the configuration space currently. But you can supplement them by kind of curve or loop dependent momentum variables. And let me just decide that this, their Poisson algebra is what I want to preserve in the quantum theory, in a representation, a quantum representation on a Hilbert space. That's, of course, a choice. And you could have made other choices. Yes. So, but this is really what is the key ingredient, or the key choice one makes when one works in loop quantum gravity. So the choice is really to promote the set of Wilson loops plus kind of suitable momentum variables, which I won't go into right now. It's not important for our discussion. Plus suitable momentum variables to well-defined operators in the quantum theory. Now, one thing I want to emphasize is that this is a non-trivial assumption. So it doesn't follow from anything straight away. Yes. And well, why is it non-trivial? Because by saying these Wilson loops should be represented by well-defined operators in the quantum theory, of course, in particular, it means by finite operators in the quantum theory, I'm making some non-trivial physical assumptions. And of course, an interpretation one has for those is that for these Wilson loops, once I've promoted them to quantum operators, they have the interpretation of being having kind of the metric or the dynamical variable just excited along a one-dimensional curve. So not in kind of some smeared out region, no, strictly along a one-dimensional curve. And well, that is a potentially non-innocent assumption. So that's how one could characterize this. That's kind of tantamount to making this choice, is one has some typical quantum states where the metric is excited along one-dimensional curves. Or actually, it turns out one has to generalize this slightly. So one certainly has to look at curves that also have intersections and even plenty of intersections. So more generally, one isn't actually dealing with the graphs. And so there is a, now you see these graphs will now appear as labels on quantum states, because I have to keep track of what's the loop in the Wilson loop. And it turns out that a nice basis for the wave functionals, now in the Silbert space one has, is given in terms of a label set that's called spin networks. So spin network is just a graph, which is embedded in sigma. And kind of, it's a slight generalization of these Wilson loops. So in order to define a spin network, you have to give me such a graph, often called gamma, and you have to make spin assignments, J1, J2, J3. And these are essentially, they're representation labels of SU2. So they're associated with links. And you have to give me some other data to tell me how I contract kind of free indices that appear with these representation data on the links, how I contract them so all the indices kind of disappear, and I get a gauge invariant quantity. So some contractions here. What are they called? Well, intertwiners. Getting you between the different kind of representations coming from the links. So I'm not going into this at all. Just think of it as a kind of glorified version of the Wilson loop. The principle is very much the same. They live directly on the quotient space and are not sensitive anymore to gauge transformations. Now, this kind of choice that is already known would not be the right thing to do for Young-Mills theory. And, well, why is that? Well, because these in Young-Mills theory and the representations that are relevant there, these Wilson loops are actually highly singular objects, which has exactly to do with being kind of peaked in a delta function-like way along one-dimensional curves. And these things have to be regularized and renormalized. And there were, some 20, 25 years ago, there were ideas to reformulate Young-Mills theory in terms of purely gauge invariant quantities like these Wilson loops. But ultimately, it failed because kind of the equations these objects satisfy formally and at a regularized level, they don't survive renormalization. So this hasn't been a very fruitful approach, at least not in continuum Young-Mills theory. But of course, one can argue, and this is of course how it has been argued, that one cannot really compare the theories of gravity and gauge theory, because the dynamics, although they live on the same phase space, is completely different. In Young-Mills theory, we have kind of a pure gauge boson action, which is of the form F squared. And here, we have still these non-trivial diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints floating around, which have are totally different. I mean, the physics contained in there is completely different. So in fact, what people have argued that in gravity, working with these loop variables is particularly natural because, of course, you still have to make them invariant under the action of diffeomorphisms, in particular spatial diffeomorphisms. And a kind of a neat way, slightly hand-wavingly saying, to have diffeomorphisms act is, of course, by moving the arguments of these Wilson loop variables. So in fact, that roughly speaking, an object, such a Wilson loop variable, is also lives on the quotient with respect to the spatial diffeomorphisms if it doesn't depend on how I move such a loop or an entire graph, how I move it around in my three space. So if you give me a functional that's invariant under this kind of motion induced by a spatial diffeomorphism, and it's constant under Z, I'd say, aha, great, this is one, you know, where I want to go to. Z objects of this kind, they live now on the reduced configuration or space, phase space with respect to both the gauge transformation and the spatial diffuse. So the fact that loops and networks, et cetera, have constant and non-trivial properties under diffeomorphisms, of course, some of them that stay constant, makes this look like a particular natural way to proceed in gravity. Although similar arguments cannot be made in gauge theory. Yes?
So why does it not matter where the loop is?
No, that's an additional condition. Now, of course, we are not yet at the full, at the physical phase space yet. We have only taken care of one set of constraints, the ones associated with local gauge rotations, SU2 rotations. And we still have all the other constraints, which we still have to apply or, you know, solve in order to get to the real physical space. Another statement is, these kind of objects have a natural, well, they have, they behave in a specific way under spatial diffuse. So it makes sense to now look at the ones that are constant with respect to application of a diffeomorphism. And that would be those, you know, I gave you the kind of the rough argument, those functionals that remain constant when I move this such a loop around by a smooth diffeomorphism. Thinking of it as an active transformation. Yeah.
So the SU2 gauge rotations have nothing to do with the diffeomorphisms?
No.
Okay. So that's extra gauge freedom?
Yeah, that's, you see, we've introduced, by going to the first order formulation, we've introduced extra internal degrees of freedom, kind of the frames, the internal frames.
Okay.
And these I can rotate locally. You know, it was an SO3-1 to start with, but then we reduced it to an SO3. Now, of course, the question arises, is this a justified choice? Well, and I think, well, the verdict is out. I mean, you just have to show that now that you work out what the quantum theory is, in the end, you know, I hand you the quantum theory and you say you're happy with it or you're not happy with it. So I think it's very difficult at this intermediate stage to say, well, this just cannot be true because, well, you know, the proof is in the pudding. Now, making this choice has led to an enormous improvement of discussing at this intermediate stage. So this is still, of course, it gives rise to another kind of auxiliary Hilbert space. So let me call this auxiliary with a prime, because I've only reduced with respect to part of the variable. It's not yet my physical thing. Essentially, one has a rigorous construction of what this is. It's a specific completion of this quotient space with respect to a particular measure. That's called the Ashtekalan Lewandowski measure. Lewandowski measure. So what is extremely neat is that one can show that once one has made this choice, then essentially, at least at this kinematical level, before taking into account the other constraint, the Hilbert space structure is uniquely fixed. So there is very little wiggle space. That's, of course, nice. You always want uniqueness in your constructions, if possible. Now, I already kind of sketched to you how one can deal with the diffeomorphism constraint. So again, that's not really the real sticking point. The real sticking point and difficulty comes now again when one has to consider the Hamiltonian constraint in this framework. I have already mentioned to you that initially kind of this Hamiltonian constraint because of a specific choice one had made, which turned the classical formulation into a kind of a complexified formulation. Initially had a very simple form, but this was abandoned. And well, I had the form of the Hamiltonian yesterday on the blackboard. That was, of course, quite non-trivial. Now, one has now moved to this representation theory, where essentially states are kind of labeled by these discrete star networks. And the way now the Hamiltonian acts, it's still, well, it knows something about this representation, as a matter of fact. So, and if you recall, it had a quadratic piece in the E's. So essentially, it acts by differentiation. And this can be interpreted on this type of state as changing, well, I would call it the combinatorial nature of these states. So application of the Hamiltonian, say, locally in the vicinity of some vertex would result in, you know, just to say something typical, in addition of some, you know, some links or even removal of some links, addition of some vertices. So just to characterize kind of the type of action it has now. And people then draw little diagrams of what happens. So you have to make an analysis, actually, kind of state by state of how this Hamiltonian acts. So so H perp, this contrast Hamiltonian, has a, so I call this kind of a combinatorial action. Action on these spin network states. And of course, some kind of regularization has to go into how one constructs the Hamiltonian. Well, that's generally non-unique, but one can certainly do that. But what helps you in addition is kind of the fact that you have kind of some underlying discreteness in these objects. So really, you have this Hamiltonian implements some kind of rearrangements locally all over the network of the ingredients of these graphs. And a very nice result is that there exists now versions of the constrained algebra of the of just these H mu's specifically in this setup, where the algebra, the constrained algebra, closes in the quantum theory. So one can make the algebra of the quantized versions of these, as the momentum and the Hamiltonian constraints close. But I should emphasize on shell. So what do I mean by this? Well, on shell is usually means, I mean, the equations of motions are satisfied. Here, what I mean by it is simultaneously, I'm looking at states which sit in the joint kernel, so are annihilated simultaneously by all of these quantum constraints. Right. That's a mu. So these are just is H perp taken together with the three momentum constraints. And that's a result by Tiemann. So it's kind of obvious, kind of if you, well, if you compare this setup with what I told you about the similar construction in the metric formulation, which was mathematically extremely shaky, very formal. Now, at least at this intermediate stage here on this auxiliary Hilbert space, I mean, before imposing the constraints, one can push this much further and really work this out in a kind of mathematically well-defined way. However, serious problems remain with regard to our friend, the Hamiltonian constraint. So the first thing is that the way this thing acts here on spin states, so that's an argument that has been made by various people, including me, is very, very local. So you have these kind of local rearrangements. And when I do something on a graph here, it's completely independent of kind of doing some what the Hamiltonian constraint does on the graph over here. So, and that's not really what you'd expect a Hamiltonian to do. So for instance, if you were to put this kind of by brute force on a kind of lattice, then you could never come up with a Hamiltonian that had this kind of ultra local way of acting. And that's important to get out the dynamics right. So now, how could you see that you're doing something wrong and that H perp doesn't do what you want it to do, kind of just comparing with the classical theory? Well, one way to check that is to actually compute what the algebra is off shell. So then you would just try to reproduce the entire Dirac algebra, these things satisfied classically, with the non-trivial right-hand sides in the quantum theory. And if that came out right, or maybe came out right up to some higher order corrections, then you'd say, well, no, look, I mean, it must have a very analogous meaning to what it has in the classical theory, but because the algebra of constraints is exactly the same. But one cannot do this. I mean, for various, also, of course, technical reasons, there's nothing one can verify here in an easy way. There is a bunch of choices one has made into quantizing this. As I said, regularization has to go into it. Various choices, really, then, of how this Hamiltonian acts concretely. And, well, it's difficult to make a choice for one or the other. I mean, they look kind of all equally good. So at least one could say, well, some ambiguities sneak in, which are difficult to control at this stage. But then, of course, finally, also, the other big question is looming. Now, what are the wave functions that are actually annihilated by this Hamiltonian constraint? So I still, well, with all worries I might have about this operator, you know, still I have pushed this program to somewhere. And I can ask, OK, now can I now solve this equation, you know, H perp hat applied on physical wave functions equal to zero? And again, there we know extremely little. So, we've done everything. Here are lots of things and lots of non-trivial things. I mean, books have been written about this, but of course, we still are then stuck with how to solve this equation. So in a way, well, we don't really know for the full theory of GR quantum gravitations. We don't know the dynamics because that's still something one has to do. Now, my personal assessment is that these are really very serious problems here. So it's not, you know, a small kind of small technicalities. I think this really goes to the heart of the matter, and it will be very difficult to make decisive progress on any of these questions. Of course, there is still work ongoing on this, and people addressing these problems. One could, of course, be slightly worried that somehow now all the difficulties one, of course, would a priori expect with presence of infinities somehow are now buried in the definition and construction of this operator. And as long as I haven't done this in a more complete manner, it's difficult, you know, to assess the status of it. and kind of nice kind of combinatorial counting and finiteness features that are present in this nice Hilbert space setup, of course, might not at all be preserved when I go kind of to the space of physical wave functions, which I currently just don't know what is. So, well, that's where we are. And so I wanted to finish this section of a course, not really in the spirit of being discouraging, but just in the spirit of giving you a quote from the founding father, one of the founding fathers of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, Bryce DeWitt, just citing from an abstract of a paper he wrote in 1997 that was called The Quantum and Gravity Assessment on Wheeler-DeWitt Equation. Now, he writes in the abstract, "This equation should be confined to the dustbin of history for the following reasons. One, by focusing on time slices, it violates the very spirit of relativity. Two, scores of man years have been wasted by researchers trying to extract from it a natural time parameter. Three, since good past integral techniques exist for basing quantum theory on gauge invariant observables only, it seems a pity to drag in the paraphernalia of constrained Hamiltonian systems." Well, that's of course his personal opinion, but well, that's, I think there is probably some grain of truth to this. Now, where to turn to? We'll be turning, together with also quite some other researchers that previously kind of worked on this exclusively canonical way of quantizing, to back to the gravitational path integral, but to a non-perturbative version of it. Now, in the non-perturbative context, this also goes by the name of sum over histories. So a history is just kind of a path, kind of the spatial geometry of traces out over time. So a history is just a piece of curved space-time with specified boundary conditions. So I can write again down the path integral here, this side. So that's an expression I already had on the blackboard back in lecture 5. So the symbol I use for the path integral is a capital Z. And well, then we had this formal way of writing the path integral, where the Einstein-Hilbert action appeared. Everything, well, depends not on G mu nu, but on equivalence, diffeomorphism equivalence classes of J mu nu. And my way of writing that was to say, well, this the measure, I mean, everything has to live on the quotient here. And this was, of course, again, one of these equivalence relations of which we've had now various. I mean, if M acts as gauge symmetries. So now we want to make sense of this away from perturbation theory. So, oops, by definition, well, the construction I look at will have two key properties. The first one is background independence. Now, what I mean by background independence is one is not distinguishing any one configuration in this space as, you know, distinguish or something you want to perturb around, whichever way. So one is really doing kind of a democratic sum or integral over histories. And the way in which I use this word background independence, you should really think of as being precisely what one does in the classical theory. Now, in the classical theory, well, you have a bunch of dynamical equations given, so you're not usually prejudicing yourself as to what the solution might be. You solve the equations, and then you have a solution, a space-time solution for given boundary conditions. Now, so that's the same thing I have in mind here. Come up, have now a dynamical principle that should generate for you some ground state of some kind for given boundary conditions again. And then you can call that your background, you can call it your ground state, or the preferred geometry that you comes out as a solution. And then, of course, at that stage, you wouldn't talk anymore about background independence once you found a specific solution, in the same way as you found whatever the Minkowski solution or a black hole solution in the classical theory. You could say, well, then that explicitly, of course, once you sit on a solution, of course, this notion of background independence does no longer make sense. And you really have one of those. Yeah?
So in classical GR, as I understand it, you solve, you have equations that govern the metric.
That's right.
And you solve for the metric. So I've always thought of a metric as extra structure that you put on a manifold, right? You have a topological manifold, and you can put a metric on it.
Yeah.
And the metric's a true form everywhere.
Sure.
So so it seems like you have to at least assume the topological properties of the manifold. You can't be totally unprejudiced.
No.
Is that accurate?
That's completely right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a very good point. So background independence is always relative. So it's it's impossible not to put anything in. I mean, you know, if I, like you were just saying, certainly what I'll be fixing here, you have to, in order for this to make any sense whatsoever, you have to suddenly fix the space-time topology. But of course, different people disagree on now, of course, so one of the inputs, you construct a theory of quantum gravity. One of the inputs you have to give me is what are the fundamental degrees of freedom. So everyone would probably be agreed that kind of metric geometry should be in there, but maybe it should be more. So maybe it should be, you should allow for topological excitations. What do you know what happens at the Planck scale? Well, maybe then topology is excited. Or more. I mean, maybe you should throw out even more of kind of classical smoothness you could throw away, a continuity of space you could just throw away. But of course, then you get increasingly further away from your classical theory. So it will just be very, very difficult to recover anything that remotely resembles, at the end in some classical limit, that of GR. So there's clearly a balance here. So you have to clearly put some structure in. Yeah, you should be completely clear of what you are putting in and what you're hoping then to get out dynamically. And you could be very ambitious, say, okay, I start with the set of all sets, and now I start quantizing. Well, in 100 years, I'll probably still be quantizing, trying to understand what it has to do, with classical GR. Well, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but just to show you kind of extreme positions one could take. Some of them are not very practical. And what I would also say is that if the world is really so that kind of a theory of quantum gravity is something relatively unique. Well, we haven't, so there's good evidence for that because we haven't found a single one yet. So there are clearly not zillions of them floating around. Well, there might be, we haven't seen them though. So if that is so, if quantum gravity is reasonably unique, and that's really an assumption you are anyway making in studying this, in wasting your time on trying to, you know, to find it. Then why make your life very difficult by choosing a very minimalistic starting point? So, and then kind of try struggling very hard to get back kind of to the geometric structure, the curvature structure, etc. So as long as you have kind of all relevant degrees of freedom somewhere in the theory, it shouldn't actually, your explicit starting point shouldn't actually matter too much. Of course, there are arguments pro and against, but this is certainly how I would argue, you know, tendentially against somewhat more ascetic approaches to quantum gravity. Okay, so this is background independence. And secondly, well, of course, it should be non-perturbative. And okay, in the first instance, it means not perturbative. More specifically, well, one will include, say, in a path integral, in a non-perturbative path integral, certainly configurations, as I said earlier, that are very, very far from any classical configurations, let alone solutions. And that's, of course, also what one should expect to be contained in here, in direct analogy with the kind of the classical a non-relativistic particle. Okay. Now, I already, when we first talked about the gravitational path integral, I told you, well, this is really terribly ill-defined. So there's a whole long list of problems, you know, what you have to specify here in order to make kind of halfway sense of this very, very formal expression. So now I'm going to explain to you kind of in the remainder of the lectures how to address explicitly some of the points that are raised there. So specifically, I'll show the following. So one way, specific way of proceeding, maybe how to work directly on this quotient space. And that's also what I'll be able to still to say some words about today. So how to work directly on this space of equivalence classes of Lorentzian metric structures, modulo diffeomorphisms. Secondly, how to regularize. Because here also kind of the infinities of any quantum field theoretic path integral have to be dealt with. And of course, in a manner that satisfies the symmetries, but that will be actually taken care of by working directly on this quotient. So regularize, and of course, also subsequently to renormalize. And thirdly, how to deal with the I. So by the I, of course, I mean this I here. So these are, of course, complex amplitudes. This is really an application of the superposition principle, right? Kind of following Feynman's prescription. Now, once I do things non-perturbatively, I will have to go beyond a Gaussian approximation where, you know, I confine myself to just looking at kind of the quadratic part in the momenta here. And the problem is, well, then I have to say how I want to do this integral. Of course, I can do Gaussians, but for any other form of the integral, I still have to explain how to do this. And this will be essentially turn out to be impossible, as long as one does this in this complex way. I mean, you regularize the path integral, and then in order to discuss its convergence behavior or otherwise as a function of these bare coupling constant and the explicit cutoff parameters you're putting in the regularization, and in order to then discuss in a nice way how this object behaves as I remove these regulators, I need this to be a real quantity. Otherwise, I cannot say very much about this. So I have to tell you, in other words, how to recrotate. You won't get to this today, but most likely tomorrow. OK, now, well, so what's a way of regularizing? So here it's really helpful to go back briefly to the analogy. Let's see, when did I start? Quarter past. No, it's a good point to stop. Stopping myself, otherwise, you know, I could go on forever, but I'll continue tomorrow. All right.